Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Interviewreihe von uns. Hier am Mikro sind Verena
und Patrick. Und wir hatten die Gelegenheit, drei Filmschaffende aus der britischen Unterhaltungsindustrie zu interviewen. Wir haben mit ihnen vor allem über die Branche in Corona-Zeiten gesprochen. Und da alle von ihnen auch in Hollywood tätig waren, haben wir den Unterschied in der Filmproduktion zwischen den USA und dem Vereinigten Königreich beleuchtet.
Unser erster Gast in dieser Folge ist Samuel Barnett, ein englischer Schauspieler, der unter anderem bekannt aus der Serie Penny Dreadful ist. Und er war auch die Titelrolle in der Netflix-Serie Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
Samuel hat uns einen Überblick über seine gesamte Karriere gegeben. Über seinen Einstieg in die Schauspielerei, seinen Sprung von der Bühne ins Fernsehen und seine Hauptrolle in einer internationalen Produktion, da er bekannt auf Bühne und Bildschirm ist. Er erzählt uns von der Unterhaltungsbranche in Großbritannien aus seinem englischen Blickwinkel und seine professionellen und persönlichen Erfahrungen in Corona- und Lockdown-Zeiten.
Und am Ende werden Patrick und ich dann auch nochmal zusammenfassen und uns ein bisschen darüber unterhalten, was wir so mitgenommen haben aus diesem sehr interessanten und persönlichen Interview. Und wünschen euch jetzt auf jeden Fall ganz viel Spaß beim Zuhören. We wanted to start a little bit with your past. So I'm not really sure just how reliable a source IMDb trivia is. But there is one bit on it, which I found interesting. And it's saying that when you were 18 years old, your friends filled in a drama school application form for you. And they told you that was where you belonged. So did that really happen?
It did really happen. I would never have gone to drama school. It was actually my very first boyfriend who filled in the drama school applications for me because I had absolutely no confidence that I could be an actor. And I also thought drama schools were for professional actors or at least proper actors, because I knew obviously that you trained to be an actor at these drama schools, but I just thought that I wasn't a proper actor. So I would never have gone if my boyfriend at the time had not filled in those application forms for me and put me on a train and made me go to those auditions.
It's really sweet.
Yeah. That's another thing to see that IMDb trivia sometimes actually posts true things. Confirmed.
sometimes they get it right.
Yeah, sometimes it's not as reliable. But yeah, that's great to know. So I think I wrote to you about that. Fairly recently, we did a admittedly very, very small audio production of Shakespeare's Twelfth Night for our book show for the Uni Radio. And every player in it voiced multiple roles. And we noticed that you actually starred in two really big productions of that play on Broadway and at the Globe. And now we chose it because our theme was Shakespeare in love and the comedy aspect seemed kind of welcome in these dire times now. So we wanted to ask you if there's anything about Twelfth Night that drew you to acting in those two staged versions, or if there's anything in particular about that play that speaks to you.
Well, I didn't realize that Twelfth Night was as funny as it turned out to be in our production. I studied Shakespeare a bit at school and I did it a bit at drama school, but I didn't really like it that much. And the so-called Shakespeare comedies, I never found them very funny. But Tim Carroll, our director for Twelfth Night at the Globe and on Broadway, he really brought out the comedy, and I realized that Twelfth Night is a sitcom. It's a situation comedy, and that was my way into it. That was how I related to it. The language can seem to me very dense, very opaque, but actually the characters, their feelings, and the situations that they are in, which are often ridiculous, but often just very human situations, can be very, very funny. And I think it's great that you did a production of it in such dark times.
Redact.
I think it's, well, you know, but even an audio production is, you know, it's great because it lifts people's spirits. It is a really funny show. And I loved it. I had never done Shakespeare before, and I was lucky enough to play both twins. So I played Sebastian at the Globe and then Viola on Broadway. And it was great playing Sebastian first because it gave me confidence with the language, because it is a smaller role. And then I really kind of felt like I got to really get into the meat of it by playing Viola, which is, I mean, it's of course men should not be playing women's roles these days. It's an extraordinarily old-fashioned thing to do, but in our all-male production, I have to say it remains one of my most favorite roles to have played. I feel really lucky to have been able to play that.
That's great. Yeah, I mean, we faced similar challenges in the way in that we had, I mean, not that similar challenges, but we had a limited amount of players, and so we also had to switch quite it a lot between roles and men playing women and women playing men and all around. Obviously with your play there was an intentional choice, but it was a cool production. So do you feel that Twelfth Night still holds up better than some other Shakespeare plays in comparison, or do you feel like that's some kind of evergreen?
I mean, I am not an expert. Can't answer that question as to whether it holds up against some others. I know that the thing about that I often find about the Shakespeare comedies is the plotting. The plot is often completely ridiculous, beyond situation comedy. Whereas, you know, the plot of Hamlet, sure, it's got holes in it, as does the plot of Romeo and Juliet, but they are magnificent. I know it's probably a cliche, but they are two of my favorite plays, you know, whether Shakespeare or not, that they remain two of my favorite plays. I think they are extraordinary in their scope of human experience, and also in the plotting and how quickly it moves. It's stuff that you would write on for a Netflix drama these days. That's the kind of plot you would have. It's vast and epic, and some of the comedies are I don't know, a little bit lumpy, I feel. But I'm really not an expert with Shakespeare at all.
Yeah, but thank you very much. That definitely sounds good. And besides starring in theatre productions, you are also no stranger to the screen, having performed, for example, in Penny Dreadful, The History Boys, and also Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, which is really awesome, by the way.
Thanks.
And yeah, it's streaming on Netflix. And I figure it must have felt really impressive back then, like seeing your own face on Netflix and Netflix posters and everything for the first time, and just taking part in representing this international franchise.
Yeah, it was quite overwhelming. I remember when it was coming out in America, and I was flown to LA to do press, and from my hotel window, and I don't know if they'd done this on purpose where they put me in the hotel, but I opened my curtains and there was a massive billboard with my face and Elijah Wood's face on it, and I couldn't quite believe it. I felt a bit embarrassed. And then in New York, our faces were everywhere on buses and billboards and bus stops. It was advertised everywhere, and it was I never quite got used to seeing my face, my sort of silly rubbery face that big on a poster. But it was thrilling and it was amazing. What felt really amazing was you know, leading a show alongside someone like Elijah Wood, and it also felt really thrilling sort of representing Britain, I guess, in a show, in a big American show like that. That felt really, really cool and really special. And also, it's one of those bucket list dreams that you kind of, that you get to tick off the list. You go, oh my God, I've played a lead in an American TV show. And I didn't even have that ambition when I was starting out at drama school and graduating and starting to work in the acting industry, I had no thoughts of ever leading a TV show in America or Britain or anywhere. So I feel, I still feel really lucky to have done that and kind of go, you know, whatever else happens, I've acted on Broadway and I've, you know, played a lead in an American TV show and been in a couple of American TV shows. And in terms of stage and TV, it feels like it doesn't get bigger than that for me. Although having said that, I recently finished watching for the second time through all three seasons of Dark, and I would kill to be in something like that. I mean, that show, I absolutely loved it. The casting, the acting, the script, the storylines, everything about it was so, so well done. And I find that with a lot of European TV, there was all the sort of Nordic noir stuff. And then a lot of German, Deutschland 83, 86, 89. I haven't watched 89 yet, but like there's so much good TV. Spiral coming out of France. There's so much good European TV that I think is very, very different to what the Americans do and to what we do here in Britain. It's got its own particular flavor, but one of the things I just love about it is the way they cast the right people. They always cast the right look, and it's not about looking a certain way. It's not about being very glossy or typically handsome or beautiful. It's just the right actor for the right role. And I love that. It feels like it's got a lot of integrity. So I wish I had studied harder in my German and French classes at school, because I would love to be in something like that. I don't suppose that's ever going to happen.
Never say never.
Never say never.
I'm sure we've got a lot of roles for Brits in there.
Yeah, that's it. You see, I could come in and just do a Brit, like an English speaking role in one of those shows. Yes, yes, please. Let's put that out there.
Yeah, but I also think that Netflix is really just a good platform to give these kind of productions a bigger audience, also international audience. That's really cool.
I agree. I would never have had access to all these shows that I watch without. I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen Elite, the Spanish show that's on Netflix, which is another one that, I mean, I absolutely love it. It's not for my generation at all. It's for teenagers. It's not for me, but it's so good. It's so well acted. It's so well written. But I agree. Yeah, Netflix is an amazing platform for watching shows from around the world, which normally we just wouldn't get here, or you'd have to pay. I guess it's like with HBO, which we still don't really have in the UK. We'd have to pay like quite a high subscription rate to get that. So yeah, Netflix has done a lot for introducing all of us to kind of great, great TV from around the world.
Absolutely. I especially agree with you about the part of European shows or Scandinavian shows in particular about this noirish aspect. I feel like Broadchurch captivated that really well, even though it was a British original show.
That's it. Broadchurch was the one where over here in the UK we all went, oh, they've copied the Scandinavian shows. But great, because it worked. Broadchurch season one particularly was very Scandi-noir. I loved it. It really didn't feel British at all. I thought it was really good.
And the casting, especially in that show and the shows that you just described in general, it's just wonderful to see. Not, and when I say not supermodels, obviously I don't mean unattractive people, but just seeing people who could be regular people you meet in the streets acting in a show about people, about regular people in the streets. It's not like, as much as I love American shows, they often cast supermodels in roles that actually should be average Joes and Janes.
Absolutely. And there is, and also what comes with that is with the European TV, I find, is there's a certain acting style which is so, I don't know if it's because it's in a different language and I watch it with subtitles, but I don't think it is that. I think there is a truthfulness to the acting that comes out of those shows that I've watched, which I long to do in TV. That very real naturalistic style, even in something like Dark, which is, you know, kind of sci-fi time travel. Sorry, I've given it away to anyone who hasn't seen it. I'm sure everyone's seen it. But or Deutschland 83, 86, 89, which again is a sort of historical piece, I guess, but there's something quite heightened. It's not always completely naturalistic, but the acting is always completely truthful and naturalistic. And I love that. I don't know that every show here and in America does that.
It's wonderful to see to hear that you're such a fan of it. So, but we already spoke about Dirk Gently, and that show was very much about the interconnectedness of all things, and it frequently showed how things and people in different spots of life are linked and influencing each other, even from a distance. And I think you talked about that in our last conversation about how fans responded to it in a way that they said it was sort of a cure or antidote for loneliness. Do you feel that this resonates more strongly now in COVID times for people watching the show, rewatching the show now, or watching it now for the first time?
Yeah, definitely. I'm quite humbled, actually, and amazed by the amount of new people who've discovered Dirk Gently on Netflix around the world, who I get messages from still, who either just love the show because they love it, or because they love that message of feeling connected. And it, I've had so many people write to me and tell me that it's helped them feel less alone, and also that it's given them comfort that, in a way, everything is happening for some reason. Everything is kind of being taken care of, even when things are really bad and really dark. We don't necessarily know why, but we know that they will pass, and we know that we can get to the other side. And I think the show gives that message, and people seem to have really responded. And also, you know, with any of these streaming platforms, they've got a captive audience with, you know, a lot of the world in lockdown. So people are discovering shows that they wouldn't otherwise necessarily have watched. And it's given it, I think, a whole new lease of life. So I think, yeah, that message is really pertinent now more than ever.
True. Yeah, I think many people feel like that. Do you have certain ways of coping with the COVID situation, lockdown, everything that you want to share? Do you meditate? Do you do yoga or anything? I mean, we saw that there was like a lockdown special for a charity event for Douglas Adams. Did that help you to reconnect with your past experience on the show, but putting it into perspective with the situation we're in now?
Yeah, it was really nice to do that. It was for Save the Rhino International, and it was the Douglas Adams Memorial Lecture. And myself and Hannah Marks, who plays Amanda in Dirk Gently, were asked to do a sketch for it. And it was lovely. It was, apart from anything, it was really, really good to reconnect with Hannah. I mean, we're still in touch, but I just hadn't seen her face. And we shot this sketch over Zoom, and that was so nice. And to connect with Arvind, who was one of the execs and creators on the show, and he wrote the sketch as well. And yeah, that was really nice. And in terms of what I do to cope, you know, it's it's varied considerably. I can't remember I think, you know, Patrick, that I told you in our conversation or emails that my dad died right at the beginning of the pandemic. So it's nearly a year since he passed away. And so my first 9 months really of us being in lockdown and coping with this were just surviving, really. And then when that sort of fog of grief started to lift, I found that I actually did need to put more in place to cope with the everyday lockdown and the lack of what felt like a life, you know, everything that gives us some direction and difference in our lives just being shut down. So Yes, absolutely. About 3-4 months ago, I started. I'd always dabbled a bit with mindfulness meditation, but I started transcendental meditation, TM, about 4 months ago. And most of the time, I just fall asleep when I do it, but it feels great. And I've also been getting back into exercising daily, and it's anything that gives me that little bit of structure. And I've also been very lucky to be able to work from home, doing a lot of audio recordings and sometimes going into studios to do that as well. So that's been a relief. But those jobs, you know, there haven't been an awful lot of them for me. And when you do them, they're over quite quickly. So I haven't been able to rely on any sense of work to give me structure or direction. So I've had to kind of create it myself. I've done a lot of baking. I've done a lot of walking. I've done a lot of reading. I've done a lot of watching Netflix. I've done a lot of worrying as well. You know, there's been a lot of anxiety, and that comes and goes, and coping with I mean, I think I suffer with anxiety anyway, regardless of then being locked down on and off for a year. So I've been back in therapy, and yeah, I think I've had to find things to help me cope. And you know what? Thank God for Zoom, really, because that's also been a really great way to connect. My best friend ended up trapped in New Zealand. We've been in touch weekly via Zoom or FaceTime, and how different that is to only a few years ago, when we wouldn't have had such stable platforms to do that on, because I've never found it that stable. Whereas, Zoom, I get on with it really well. And so I've been able to keep in touch with all my friends and family, which has been great.
That's wonderful. Yeah. I mean, again, sincere condolences about your loss.
Thank you.
Yeah, sorry.
It's Thanks. Awful to have that happen in the pandemic as a result of the pandemic. But I think in a strange way, it helps you to shift focus and prioritize things, even though you're not overly busy with work as you used to before. I think you were probably grateful to spend the time for other things in private now, yeah. I just assume, especially now. Definitely. With connecting with friends and things.
Well, I'm relieved that, we were all very scared of COVID. And in a way, the worst thing happened straight away. I lost someone because of COVID. But then I'm really grateful that I was still working bits here and there through all of that. But there wasn't a lot of work. And I'm so grateful that for me personally, life wasn't carrying on as normal, because I needed the time and space to grieve. And actually, lockdown gave me that. I don't know how people cope normally when they lose someone and they have to still get on with work, life, bringing up children, everything, every day. I suppose people just do because you have to. But I feel very grateful for the time and space that lockdown has afforded me. And you're right, it makes you... It also did, actually. It's funny how much time grief takes up, because I was distracted. I didn't notice most of lockdown for the first 9 months. I didn't complain about it because I really did have something else to focus on. And you're absolutely right, Patrick, you come out of something like that and your priorities have changed. They've shifted, you know, things that were important to me are just not that important anymore. It's good that it's helped put everything in perspective.
Yeah. I guess you'd have to see the chances wherever you see them.
Mm,
I mean, it's great. It's great that you managed to stay connected with your friends in New Zealand. Actually, that's a good place to be trapped in right now. It's just a place that's very, very far away.
It's the best. We all want to be in New Zealand, right? I mean, it's just the best place to be. I'm sure they don't want all of us being in New Zealand. But I think right now. Yeah, exactly. But I think it is a very good place to be trapped. Yeah, it was weird. Like I talked to her a few weeks ago and she was rehearsing for a play, and I was like, oh my god, what's that like? Because it's just so normal for most of the time there. They've done amazingly well in controlling it and getting rid of it most of the time.
I almost started cry laughing recently when I read a news headline about Australia when they were like, yeah, they have to impose COVID restrictions right now too, because now crowd gatherings of over 500 people are forbidden. I was like, yeah,
yeah, for
you guys. You poor guys.
Yeah, or like when they go, we're locking Sydney down because we've had 19 cases. And over here at that point, we were on something like 65,000 new cases a day. The figures, they become so big, you can't kind of hold them in your head. But yeah, those countries that did close their borders and lock down properly have probably fared much better than certainly we have in the UK.
It's a weird situation, yeah. Let's see how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, you already answered some of that, but we also wanted to ask you if you also have seen maybe some chances due to the crisis, or like things that you wouldn't have done otherwise, work-wise. Like we also saw, for example, that you did a video game recently. It was Cyberpunk.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that in terms of opportunities that might not have come if we weren't in lockdown, if this pandemic wasn't happening, because there has been more stuff that's even plays and things that you might have done, you know, as a play, and suddenly they go, well, let's do it online, or let's do it as an audio production. And I've certainly probably had more audio work in the last year than I would normally get. Cyberpunk was something that I had been doing for nearly 2 years. It came out, I guess, during 2020, but I'd been on that since about 2018. But I did, just before lockdown, I did get another video game. And it's quite a big one. And I was able to do the first couple of recording sessions from my little home studio with lots of duvets over me and a microphone. So I'm really glad I've still been able to work. And just glad that video game, for example, which will probably, I guess I might be on that for the next year or 18 months. I'm just glad that I didn't have to lose that. Because that was the fear, you know. When we locked down in Britain, I was doing a play. I'd done day one of rehearsals of a play, and I had an independent film that I was due to shoot a bit later in the year, and I had that video game. And of course, all three of those jobs just stopped, just went. And the video game, of course, was the only one that could start again in lockdown. So I'm just trying to think if there have been other things. I'm not sure. I mean, I've got a lot of friends who've been doing the odd bit of filming stuff here and there when it's been safe to do it. And I have been auditioning. I tell you, that's one of the things that's changed, the way we audition, because auditioning over Zoom or Skype has become a lot more normal. Even before the pandemic, but I hadn't done an awful lot of it over Zoom. And so I've had to get used to that. And it's tricky, it's difficult, it's very technical. And I've been up for two big jobs recently, one in America and one here in the UK. And I had to do both of them on Zoom. And it was really weird. I didn't know where to look. Do I look at the camera? Do I look at me? Like it was, I mean, in the end, acting is acting, but it was tricky without being there in the room, because I've done a lot of self-tapes before. That's normal, you know, recording myself and sending that off. But doing it live over Zoom is very different to having that person with you in the room physically. There's something about the physical presence of one another that helps the acting. And without that, it's trickier, but it's still manageable. But that's something that I think is going to continue to be much more normal. I think everybody's realized that you don't have to spend thousands of dollars flying somebody out to another country to audition when you can do it over Zoom.
Yeah, that's one good thing to hopefully come out of that.
Yeah.
Seems like that worked out pretty well. Did the audiobook work out? I think that was the gig you worked on last time when we talked.
Yes, done that. Yeah, so that should be out very soon. Yeah, that was nice, actually. That was a new opportunity. I've always wanted to, and I'd never actually done an audiobook. But I wasn't... Actually, that's not true. I did do a shortened version of an audiobook for BBC Radio 4. A couple of times I've done that. But this was one of those Audible books. And they actually split the readers into five, I think it was five or six different characters. So I got to play one of those. And that was quite intense reading. Just reading page after page after page is surprisingly tiring. I would start getting words wrong without realizing I've got words wrong. And actually, a few months after we finished, they came back and said, "You've got two words wrong and we cannot make it work and you need to re-record this." So yeah, it was a nice new opportunity though to do something a bit different.
Wonderful. Yeah. Cool. The chances that happen out of the crisis, I guess. But after you, and now you already hinted at flying actors out from one country to another for a large sum of money. And you obviously have a lot of experience in both the UK and the US in multiple productions. And we are very interested, especially for the focal point of our show, in the process of the entertainment industry across different countries. And so what are, for you personally, as an actor especially, what are some key differences in the work process of an actor between Britain and America, whether it be in terms of casting or in terms of actually shooting a movie or a TV show?
One of the biggest differences I found between the UK and America is that in America, it all happens very quickly. And I feel like the UK just takes longer to make those decisions. Whereas in America, they get your self-tape and then they want to screen test you and then they want to offer you the job or not. And it can all happen very quickly. And in the UK, I've done auditions where I got the job 3 months after I auditioned and I forgot that I'd even auditioned for that job because it's taken so long. I think once I got a job 6 months later, and that to me seems crazy, but they just move at different paces. The biggest difference as well between the US and the UK is money, that there is so much more money in the US for these productions. So everything is just sort of, I don't know, for want of a better word, everything is just bigger over there. It feels more that there's more pressure, literally, in terms of the amount of people on a production in America who have to approve of you for that role. There are far more people that you have to please and impress. So it feels like higher pressure, higher stakes over there. But actually, the thing of getting a job, it's the same over there as it is over here. You still want it just as much, no matter what the budget is. You still have to impress, no matter whether it's two people or a panel of 20 people sitting there. It's the same in theatre. I've done theatre auditions over there where there would be a panel of 15 to 20 people sitting there looking at you. Terrifying. Whereas in the UK here, you might have, you know, for a play, the director and the casting director. And then there are really big differences on set. That in America, everybody has their job to do and they do that job and you do not do anyone else's job. So if you are not a props person, you do not pick up that prop. As an actor, you don't move a chair if that's not your job. Whereas in the UK, I feel like it's a bit more, we all just do everything. Oh, does that chair need moving? I'll move a chair. Does the prop need putting back over here? I'll put it back. I got told off. I got yelled at for doing that in America because I didn't know that it's all very delineated and very strict over there. They're very protected by their unions, and that's great. That's quite right. And it provides a lot of work for a lot of people. But you have to, you know, I didn't learn that at drama school. No one warned me. But yeah, off the top of my head, those are some of the main differences. I guess guess the other one is that it is a bigger pool in the US. So if you're right for the role, you'll probably get the role. Whereas I think in the UK, it's a much smaller pool. The competition is a lot harder. It's a smaller pool, but there are still loads of actors. So you might be right for the part, but you might not have enough profile. You might not be a big enough name, so you won't necessarily get that. Whereas, you know, I can't imagine if Dirk Gently was cast over here that I would get that role in the UK. But in the US, I guess I'm right for the part, so I get the role. Yeah, I think that's a big difference as well.
And you defended it rightly. I mean, you mentioned it in the beginning. I was actually quite skeptical when the show was announced. I was like, okay, they're setting it in America completely. And I love the show, the way it was written and produced and directed and visualized. But it was, I mean, obviously they had to, but it was great that they kept Dirk Gently British and that you kept that essence for the show. I think that was important to you as well.
It was important. I wasn't sure if I was going to have to do, for the audition that I did, I wasn't sure if I was going to have to do an American accent. And they said, no, he will be British, because I'd read the books as well. And I thought they were unadaptable, untranslatable, really. I didn't think you could put them on screen. And actually, I think picking up really from where the third book leaves off halfway through, when Dirk has actually gone to America in that third book, which was unfinished, I think picking up from there and keeping the essence of the first two books really freed the show up. So actually you weren't trying to adapt the original books. The show was very much inspired by them. And I agree. I mean, you got to keep Dirk British. It's he's quintessentially English, with all the good and bad that comes with that. So I couldn't imagine him as an American character at all. I'm glad they didn't do that.
Yeah, worked all out in the end. Just to piggyback off on the last end of the question, how would you describe the state of the entertainment industry, whether it be film, TV or theater right now? Have you seen, I mean, obviously you've seen the repercussions, but how would you describe them all in all about the state of theaters and something?
Oh God, it's pretty devastating, I have to say. We've had theatres close over here, as in they will not reopen after everything opens up. The struggle that a lot of theatres have had to survive. And then there's all the freelancers, such as myself, and all the creatives who are also, a lot of us, struggling to survive. I think filming, I can only really speak for the UK, but I think filming is operating at probably about 30%, 20-30% of what it's normally at, which is still amazing that any is happening at all. But theatre, it's dead. It's dead. All people are managing to do is, which is brilliant. I mean, God, they've adapted so well. There's a lot that's happening online, and I've watched a lot of it, and it's fantastic. But live theatre must be at 5%. I can't imagine it's at any more than that. And it makes me so sad. It's also, you know, our government, I think, has cottoned on to how much even the theatre industry, never mind the filming industry, but just the theatre industry alone brings into our economy. I think they've finally understood that. And they have come up with a package of support. It's not enough. We're going to need more. It's definitely not as much as some of the European countries have come up with, but it's something. And it is a recognition that not only does it bring a lot into the economy, but look at where we have all turned to in lockdown. We have all turned to the arts. We've turned to Netflix. We've turned to films. We've turned to, I don't know, online theatre. And so many of the actors, directors, producers, especially writers who are writing our massive Netflix shows these days, come from theatre. So if we don't have theatre, we will not have the same route for people to write those shows. Those people will not have the opportunity to hone their craft before you know, if they want to, being able to move into screen work. And it, that's not to say that theatre is only there to provide for screen. It isn't. But the reality is it does provide for screen. And without theatre, that's just not going to be the same. So I think our government over here gets that now. There's been a lot of very clever, brilliant lobbying that's happened from our industry to get the government to understand that. It's also terribly sad that a lot of people will not rejoin the arts once this pandemic is over, because they can't afford to, because they've had to go elsewhere. And I also, I was going to say, I also wonder if as much work will be made, but my hope is that there will be a sort of roaring 20s, you know, where everything comes roaring back, and there's so much theatre and so much production and so many new things. And I hope, fingers crossed, that that is what will happen. But right now, it is a really sad state of affairs. And although we have this so-called roadmap for unlocking Britain and, you know, a date at which theatres are meant to open, I don't see that happening. I think, you know, our theatres are supposed to open from June the 21st without social distancing. And I do not understand how that's achievable. I think if anything, a lot of theatres will be waiting until the autumn to see how our vaccination programme has gone, and to see how that has curbed the spread. Because if it looks like it really is containing the spread, then it will be safe to reopen without social distancing. So, sorry, that's a bit sad, isn't it? I am hopeful. I really am hopeful. And I miss, I really miss theatre. And the production that I was supposed to be doing last year is hopefully going to be happening in spring of 2022. So that's something to look forward to. Hopefully by then things will be so much more back to normal. But in my head, I'm giving it another year for things to really return to normal. I think it's too soon to think otherwise.
Yeah, but definitely thank you very much for that insight. And yeah, I also think it's just really frustrating seeing this industry suffer when obviously it helped so many people get through this situation. But yeah, in the end, we wanted to turn to happier times anyway. And you already mentioned hoping to do theatre again. But yeah, we just wanted to ask you if there are specific hopes and maybe perspectives that you have for the time, hopefully in the not too distant future, after COVID.
Do you mean sort of personal hopes for me?
Both, whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think, like I've already said, one of my biggest, was actually, I'll say this first of all, I do feel it's difficult to talk about the arts as being a sort of essential thing, because we are not saving lives and we are not delivering food and all of that. And I know all of that is true. And what is also true is that, like I said, the arts is something that we have all turned to, I think, even if it's just TV. To watch TV for comfort in these dark times, I certainly have. So I think the arts does give a service to society. And not only that, I think it's a really natural part of humanity to be creative in whatever way that is, whether that's gardening or the arts or whatever. So I think creativity is sort of looked down on as non-essential. And I think it's absolutely essential. You can even be creative just making a meal, just making some food. So my general hope is that that is more sort of widely recognized and appreciated, not just, you know, acting and the arts, but creativity itself. Like, we got creative and made a vaccine. That's creativity, you know. It's science, but it's creativity. So, but in terms of my industry, yeah, my big hope is that, as I said, it does come back with a vengeance, and that one of my hopes is that it isn't just going to be big star names doing everything in order to, you know, get people to buy tickets. My hope is that people will just want to see theatre and want to come. And I think they will. There was a very brief time last October when things were sort of opened up again and a bit of theatre was on and people came. People wanted to watch it. People wanted to pay money to see theatre. I personally really hope that this play that I was meant to do last year does go on in spring next year. It's a beautiful, beautiful play called The Southbury Child by Stephen Beresford, who wrote a movie called Pride, which was out, when was that? A few years ago, I think. But it's a beautiful play. It's like a modern day Chekhov. It's gorgeous. And I really hope that gets done. I've also got a couple of TV shows, one for the BBC and one for HBO Max, neither of which have come out yet. So I hope that they come out very soon, sometime this year. And one thing I will say is that, you know, for me, it's just my own personal journey with acting. I've never had consistent work and I've never had consistent auditions, and actually the pandemic hasn't massively affected that for me. It's not unusual for me to have, you know, only one or two auditions say in 4 months. That's not unusual for me. So it's sort of hard for me to talk about before and after, because in a way I'm oddly consistent in how I work in the auditions that I do in terms of the frequency of jobs and the frequency of auditions. And I'm very lucky that when I do work, it's really nice stuff. So I hope for more of that. But like I said earlier, my perspective has shifted. I want to act. It's the only thing I know how to do. But it's also not my life. And I feel a lot better that I have that perspective on it now. It's not, if I had to stop tomorrow, I'd do something else. And I never used to think that would be the case, but that's the truth now. I also hope that, you know, just in a bigger sense, I just hope there's less of this sort of, how else to say it? I hope there's less nationalism, you know? I hope there's more sharing. I hope there's more kindness. I think actually the pandemic has shown that that can happen and has shown that actually things globally work better when we behave, when we take care of what's happening locally, but we behave globally, we share. Basically, that's just my that's my three wishes, kind of rub the lamp and tell the genie that I want world peace, you know. but I think some great things have come out of us having to stop as human beings and look at ourselves and look at the way we do things. And I hope that kind of awareness continues.
Und das war unser Gespräch mit Samuel Barnett. Wir möchten uns bei ihm nochmal ganz herzlich bedanken, dass er sich die Zeit für unser Interview genommen hat. Und ich kann auch sagen, dass es für uns beide ein ziemlich angenehmes und interessantes Interview war. Verena, was konntest du denn mitnehmen oder was fandest du am aufschlussreichsten von unserem Gespräch mit Sam?
Ich fand den Punkt zum Beispiel sehr interessant, wo er so über seinen Eindruck von europäischen Serien im Allgemeinen gesprochen hat. Gerade wenn man es eben vergleicht mit US-Serien. Und ja, auch total witzig, was er da erzählt hat, wie das zum Teil so abläuft mit dem Stuhl, dass man da nicht mal als Schauspieler, dass man da nicht mal einen Stuhl irgendwo hintragen sollte. Das sind ja einfach so Eindrücke, die bekommt man sonst gar nicht so. Und das fand ich richtig schön, mit ihm da einfach mal so drüber zu reden.
Absolut, das war ein richtig schöner Einblick hinter die Kulissen über Sachen, wo ich mir persönlich auch so noch nie Gedanken dazu gemacht habe. Außerdem war es auch, wie du schon gesagt hast, sehr cool, dass er von sich aus mit den europäischen Serien angefangen hat, weil man da auch gemerkt hat, dass er sich Gedanken drum gemacht hat, wofür sich unser Publikum interessieren könnte und er eben auch viele Beispiele für gute deutsche Serien oder generell europäische Serien aufgezählt hat, die ihm persönlich gefallen und die er auch in seiner Freizeit gerne geschaut hat.
Genau, und ich fand das Gespräch mit ihm auch im Allgemeinen einfach sehr, sehr angenehm und dass er auch so offen und persönlich über sein eigenes Leben ja erzählt und reflektiert hat, das finde ich ja auch gar nicht so selbstverständlich. Das fand ich von daher auch total schön, dass wir da noch einen etwas tiefsinnigeren Einblick hatten und ja auch gerade jetzt in Corona-Zeiten, wo ja auch viele irgendwie ja ihre eigenen Baustellen haben, denke ich, ist das immer auch schön für die Zuhörenden zu hören, wie er so umgeht mit seinem alltäglichen Leben.
Absolut, er war wirklich ein sehr nahbarer Interviewgast, was es auch für uns sehr angenehm gemacht hat, mit ihm zu sprechen. Und dafür, dass er die Titelrolle in einer internationalen Netflix-Produktion hatte, war er doch sehr bodenständig von dem Eindruck, den wir jetzt von ihm gewinnen konnten. Und es war auch sehr schön zu hören, dass er sich so Gedanken gemacht hat über die Fanantwort auf Dirk Gently in Corona-Zeiten und wie viele Themen aus der Serie jetzt vielleicht aktueller wirken und er auch dankbar ist für die Gelegenheit, die er da hatte und sich eben darum kümmert, was die Zuschauer und Zuschauerinnen davon denken.
Also war es alles in allem auf jeden Fall ein sehr interessantes und nettes Interview, in dem wir sehr viel gelernt haben über die Unterhaltungsbranche in Großbritannien und den USA und ja, Unterschiede oder auch Gemeinsamkeiten und wie sich das Ganze natürlich jetzt auch in Corona-Zeiten gestaltet.
Und damit bedanken wir uns auch schon bei euch allen fürs Zuhören. Wir hoffen, es war für euch so informativ und auch unterhaltsam, wie es für uns war. Und hoffen, dass ihr auch bei unserer nächsten Folge wieder einschaltet.